Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, September 17th, 2019. It's been a busy day here at the Secret Studio. I connected with globetrotting journalist Pepe Escobar from his hideaway in Bangkok. And he had so much to say that I'm going to split it up into two different in-depth interview podcasts. The first is being released today, where we discuss the breaking news from Saudi Arabia, the attack on the Abqaiq oil facility last Saturday, and the international implications. We'll cover that here in just a moment. The second part of today's installment covers Pepe's exclusive interview in prison of the former president of Brazil, Lula da Silva. And he also, while he was in Brazil, had dinner with Dilma Rousseff, the president who succeeded Lula, who herself was impeached in 2016. And it's quite an interview related to Brazil. We air out the issues that implicate the United States and the Obama administration in the early efforts to tap the phones of Dilma Rousseff and her colleagues and to set the stage for regime change in Brazil. And I highly recommend the interview. I'll get it posted just as fast as my little fingers can type, okay? So Pepe also made news in describing his impressions of the military capabilities of the Houthi rebels of Yemen. And thanks to George Mashke, you're right, it's Houthi, not Houthi. The Hutus were in Rwanda, the Houthis are in Yemen. And what Pepe argues, based on his extensive contacts with various elements in Iran, is that yes, Iran has provided technical support, advisors, but that the Houthis have developed drone and cruise missile capabilities of their own over the past year or less. And he describes this as one of the most astounding incidents of asymmetrical warfare in recent time. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Pepe Escobar.
I always talk about Yemeni military advance with people in Iran. And what they always tell me is that Iran is not this myth that you have in the U.S. that the Iran-allied Houthi. No. Tehran, they support, they don't have a budget to support the Houthi armed forces. They send military advisors, engineers, some Iranian designs like the Sumar missile was copied by the Houthis. They got inspiration for their drone technology. But it doesn't mean that Iran has soldiers, contingents, IRGC forces, Al-Quds forces, etc. in Yemen advising them. No, that's not the case. So, and the Houthis, they made huge progress this past few months. And the fact that the spokesman of their armed forces, the day after the attack on Abqaiq, they said, no, we did it. And not only we did it, it's because it was a very complex intelligence operation for months, etc. But the crucial part, we had very good cooperation from people inside Saudi Arabia. And for me, this is the absolute killer part of the whole thing, because this means they have Yemenis circulating in southern Saudi Arabia back and forth in the desert, and they could also have collaboration from Shiites in the eastern province working in the oil installations of Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia, in fact, the Wahhabi House of One Saudi, the Khashoggi killer, MBS, he is at war not only with Yemen, which the UN correctly says it's a humanitarian disaster of biblical proportions, but he's also at war with the Shiite population, 15% of Saudi Arabia's population in the eastern province, which happened, most of them, they happen to work in the oil installations as well.
I'm releasing part one of my conversation with Pepe Escobar today. And my subscribers can find it at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. Now to the corporate media version of the attack on the critical oil site in Saudi Arabia. And the Washington Post asked the question, after the U.S. has gifted and sold so much of its high-tech military weaponry to Saudi Arabia, how did this happen? What about those Patriot missile batteries that the Saudis have bought from the U.S. at $1 billion a pop? Well, a scholar at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy told the Post this was really a flawless attack, adding that evidence suggests that only one of 20 missiles may have missed its target. That's astounding, he said. And again, this is in the voice of the Washington Post. U.S. officials have suggested that at least part of the attack was launched from Iran. Now, that's a revision. Part of the attack? The other suspicions are that it may have come from a ship in the Persian Gulf. But we have much more confusion around alleged evidence here than we do anything that really is persuasive. So, Vladimir Putin, meeting in Turkey with the leaders of Iran and Turkey, said that Saudi Arabia should buy the Russian-made S-300 or S-400 missile defense. He said they will reliably protect all infrastructure objects of Saudi Arabia. And the report is that that caused Iranian President Rouhani to grin. So when Saudi officials claim to have shot down a ballistic missile fired by the Houthis in 2017, a team of researchers argued in a report that the Patriot missile system, in fact, had done nothing to intercept it. Now we are told, after initially it was more than a dozen drones that were used, that both drones and cruise missiles appeared to have been used, with suggestions, and all of this, of course, comes from leaks from anonymous intelligence sources, that the weapons were launched from multiple locations. Saudi Arabia has several missile defense systems that can target low altitude incoming, but it depends on where the batteries were placed. The defended area for a Patriot is described as relatively small. And, of course, I've done investigation with Ted Postol, the professor emeritus at MIT, who has said that Israel's Iron Dome operates with less than a 10% kill rate and that the Patriot missiles have operated at about the same level. So it gets fascinating here as we see the efforts to piece together evidence that can support the narrative that has already been produced. And as I discussed with Pepe, we've seen, and Israel is the master at this, when events like this occur, the first party to get an assertion of a narrative out there usually wins the rhetorical or propaganda war. Now, one important thing to underscore that I did mention yesterday, and I also cover this in the interview with Pepe, is that the United States has zero treaty obligations to Saudi Arabia. And let's quote from the American Conservative, where Daniel Larrison published yesterday, "The U.S. is not obliged to come to Saudi Arabia's defense. No matter who was responsible for the attack on their oil installation, the U.S. has no business responding with military action. Saudi Arabia is not an ally in any sense of the word. We have no mutual defense treaty with them. We are not required to come to their aid when they are attacked. In all likelihood, this attack was the result of Saudi Arabia's ongoing aggression against Yemen. But even if it wasn't, there is no American commitment to fight on their behalf." And they continue, "Even if the U.S. were obliged to come to Saudi's aid, the president can initiate hostilities on the say-so of a foreign government. An attack on Saudi Arabia is absolutely not considered an attack on the U.S. Unless Congress authorizes military action, the president cannot legally order a military strike under these circumstances." And in the Washington Post story I was citing a moment ago, under the byline of Adam Taylor. He notes that Trump pushed the Saudi military to continue to make purchases, but on Monday he suggested that the U.S. does not have an obligation to protect the kingdom, and that if there is a conflict, Riyadh would foot the bill. Quote from Trump, "The fact is that the Saudis are going to have a lot of involvement in this if we decide to do something. They'll be very much involved, and that includes payment." But even as our stable genius correctly states the lack of any alliance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, the clear implication is that we'll be right there to fight the war for them or with them as long as they pay the bill. And that is a certainly mistaken idea of the guy in the Oval Office. Meanwhile, they're trying to... You remember back when Sir David Manning was in Washington, January of 2003, and he went back to Britain and reported to the Prime Minister that the Bush administration was trying to fix the intelligence around the predetermined plan to invade Iraq. Now we have a predetermined narrative that Iran was responsible, and we're trying to fix the intelligence around that. So, to the New York Times and Eric Schmidt, analysts are poring over satellite imagery of the damaged sites and assessing radar tracks of at least some of the low-flying cruise missiles that were used. Communication intercepts from before and after the attacks are being reviewed to see if they implicate Iranian officials. Forensic analysis is underway of missile and drone parts from the attack sites, including at least one mostly intact cruise missile recovered from the area. American military investigators are in Saudi Arabia working with counterparts to examine the guidance mechanism in the cruise missile that was recovered. They're hoping they can trace the missile's flight path using data in the guidance system back to its origin. Well, that could provide some hard evidence. And just a couple of paragraphs later, after we learn that they're investigating, we reach the narrative. American officials say they have no doubt the drones and missiles were Iranian technology, but they have not yet released information on whether the strikes were planned and directed by Iran and launched by Iran's proxies in the region, or whether they were actually launched from Iranian territory. Intelligence officials have ruled out Yemen as the origin of the attacks and do not believe they emanated from Iraq either. And that's where Pepe Escobar becomes the only voice I've heard, suggesting that the Houthis are capable of this and the most likely suspects. Mike Morrell, former acting director at the CIA, who probably would have been director in a Clinton administration, he said that if Iran was found responsible for directing or carrying out the attacks, it would amount to an act of war, and the United States would need to respond. That is bullshit. We've covered that. It might have been an act of war against Saudi Arabia. It is not an act of war against the United States. And this shows how little difference there is between spooks who lean Democratic and those who lean Republican. And here's some cautionary note. Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, noted the danger of the current situation is there's little effective way to communicate with the Iranians to avoid escalation and miscalculation. Quote, "It's a situation ripe with the possibility of miscalculation. We have not had a good line of communication with Iran since 1979. So if something happens, the odds of us getting it right are pretty small." And over on the other side, in Tehran, the New York Times speculates that the hardliners there think that they can continue to tweak Trump. And, of course, the Times accepts at face value that Iran was responsible for the tanker attacks back in May and June, although we have never seen evidence of that. Tehran, according to the Times here, has concluded that its recent aggressions have effectively strengthened its leverage with the West and in the region. And despite occasional outbursts of threats, Trump is deeply reluctant to risk an open-ended military confrontation that would endanger world oil supplies in the middle of a re-election campaign. And there may be some validity to that. But I believe Trump thinks that a war would give him cred. People wouldn't want to change horses in the middle of a war, that old saw. So It makes him unpredictable, hard to read. He thinks that ambiguity is helpful. But as the Joint Chiefs former chair said, this could lead to massive miscalculation. I want to credit Matt Taibbi as one of the clear journalists who employs skepticism on a regular basis. And I have linked to his latest effort, which is Matt Taibbi blasts the Smolenkov saga as latest pile of BS dumped on us by intel agencies. Now, I will note that this is published at a blog called Nation and State, not at Taibbi's home base, Rolling Stone magazine. I can only offer that as information. I don't know why. But he writes that the episode last week involving a tale of a would-be American spy exfiltrated from Russia solidifies his impression that our media has lost it. That's my language. Seldom has a news story been more transparently fraudulent, he says. And he goes through the details that we have reported here before, that at first CNN reported this without naming the Russian. They said that it was Trump's fault. They implied that because Trump had been loosey-goosey with our nation's secrets and sharing them with Russians, that they had to pull this guy out before he was exposed. But as Taibbi notes, there was a plan under the Obama administration to extract him. And he said, it's characteristic of third world countries to have intelligence, the intelligence world, and the media intertwined. We're now in that same paradigm in America. CNN has hired nearly a dozen former intelligence or counterintelligence officials as analysts in the last few years. Their big get was former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and now they've hired Andy McCabe, the former deputy FBI chief. And over at MSNBC, NBC, John Brennan is being paid to leak stuff that, you know, is part of his self-interest. And Taibbi compares it to 2003 and 2004, when the cable networks had all those retired generals, the rent-a-generals, I called them. They didn't identify the military-related corporate boards they serve on. And Taibbi says that CNN and MSNBC both employ former senior intelligence officials who comment on stories in which they had direct involvement, especially the Russia investigation. Now, Taibbi goes into great detail here. He shows you how the Washington Post and New York Times narratives make the suggestion by claiming that things occurred in the same time frame, the extraction of Smolenkov from Russia at the same time Trump was meeting with people in the Oval Office. And Taibbi correctly concludes that that is misleading. And there is no there there. So it's a great piece. I encourage you to read it. And we may have more on this episode coming up in the next few days here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Also related to spies, we reported last week that there are stingrays up and down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., some deployed right near the White House. Stingrays are these boxes that pose as a cell site. All phones have to check in with them. And the word on the street, leaked from the FBI, is that these stingrays belong to the State of Israel. Of course, Israel denies that they ever spy in the United States. Not ever. And Trump is unfazed by this because he considers Israel to be his great friend. John Kiriakou, quoted in this Mint Press article, says it's disingenuous to the point of offensiveness for the Israelis to protest that they do not spy on the United States. They've been caught red-handed many times in the past. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Susan Gavet, Faith Peoples, Suzanne Bowen, and Aidan McAleer. They each kick in $5 or $10 a month. This one is $20 in Faith's case. And I invite you to join them. That's how I cover my expenses and try to keep this podcast going. So pop in at peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu. Click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and be able to choose the level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you want to communicate with me by the U.S. mail, I'm at P.O. Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Providing free promotion for Ed Snowden's new book, Permanent Record, the U.S. government has filed a civil lawsuit to recover any profits because he has violated his non-disclosure agreements when he was hired by both the CIA and NSA, and he failed to submit his book for pre-publication review. Oh, the balls of that guy. Well, he tipped off in the initial publicity that the publisher gave him a big advance, and he's pocketed it. And so whatever lawsuit is going to be over the trailing revenues from the book, not from the advance. Last night in New York's Washington Square Park, Elizabeth Warren filled the place, and she gave a powerful speech with twin themes, one about the power of women. And my reading of her speech indicates there was a little bit to the exclusion of men. But she was regaling her fans with the story of the Flatiron Protest, which is almost 100 years ago, led by a woman named Frances Perkins, who went on to rewrite New York State's labor laws. She persisted. And Warren articulated the Tim Carpenter. Remember Tim Carpenter? He was the fiery leader of Progressive Democrats of America, passed away a few years ago. He talked about the inside-outside strategy, and Warren attributes it to Frances Perkins. Working the system from the inside, the women workers organizing and applying pressure from the outside, they rewrote New York State's labor laws from top to bottom to protect workers. And Warren's secondary theme was the announcement of a plan to clean up Washington, D.C. She has a lot of good ideas for, restricting lobbyists from bundling and cleaning up the campaign finance system. They all, of course, require buy-in from Congress, and that remains to be developed. Today on Capitol Hill, Corey Lewandowski did appear. He had been advised by the White House that he could skip it, and former White House staffer Rob Porter and another guy who had been subpoenaed by the Judiciary Committee in its so-called impeachment investigation declined to show up. The second guy was Rick Dearborn, a former Trump campaign advisor. And Corey Lewandowski kind of split the difference because he did show up. He stonewalled as if he had not. He began with an opening statement that won cheers from Trump, who was watching on Air Force One as he came to California. And he mocked the Democrats for their investigation of Trump, dismissed the fake Russian collusion narrative. And as you know, I'm sympathetic to that position, but Lewandowski admitted that Trump asked him to go talk to Jeff Sessions and to get Jeff to dial back the Bob Mueller investigation. Now, Lewandowski says that he didn't believe Trump told him to do anything illegal, but that he never went through with the order. He didn't carry it out because he went on vacation with his kids. And that's about as substantive as an answer as I've seen coming from him. Now, after stonewalling, he did finally admit that Trump ordered him to do that, but he said that he didn't think it was illegal. Here's the description. In Volume 2 of the Mueller report, Trump met with Lewandowski in the Oval Office 2 days after he directed his counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Bob Mueller. This time, Trump criticized Jeff Sessions, who was then the attorney general, for recusing himself, and asked Lewandowski to deliver the attorney general a message that he dictated on the spot. Questioned by Democratic Congressman Steve Cohen of Tennessee, didn't you think it was a little strange the president would sit down with you one-on-one and ask you to do something you knew was against the law? Lewandowski, I didn't think the president asked me to do anything illegal. So Democrats had hoped that this was going to, put a chink in the armor and lead to something else. And I don't see that happening. I'll have to await my review of video excerpts from this hearing later today. As I mentioned, Trump is coming to California. We have determined that the fundraisers being held At the $95 million home of former Sun Microsystems executive or CEO Scott McNeely, and that's in Portola Valley, which is near. I doubt that Trump will set foot in the city of San Francisco itself. And true to form, and I've pointed this out before, and forgive my crudeness, but it seems that Trump determines that wherever he goes, he's going to shit on that place. I don't know if it's primal behavior where he thinks he is marking his turf, but he decided that this is the day he's going to tweak California by announcing that he is ending the waiver that the state's 1970s Clean Air Act was passed. And since that time, California has had higher, stricter standards for tailpipe emissions, and the auto industry has cooperated. And Trump is taking on both California and the auto industry because the car makers have come to terms with California. They want to maintain the dual national standards. It's a way of them to offset the costs of R&D of higher mileage cars. But Trump, determined to tweak California and to hammer the legacy of Barack Obama, is going to shit all over it. And just to give you an example, the current standard in California would require fuel economy of 54 miles per gallon by 2025, and the Trump rule will reduce that to 37 mpg. Well, a lot of people got excited when excerpts of the new book by New York Times reporters about the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process was excerpted the other day. And now the allegations in that excerpt are under attack because the Washington Post tracked down a key witness who had declined to appear with Christine Blasey Ford last year and who had been tight-lipped, to say the least. Her name is Leland Kaiser, and she was allegedly the other girl who was at the party where Brett Kavanaugh climbed all over Christine Blasey Ford in a drunken attempt to sexually assault her. And Kaiser has never corroborated Ford's account or even key details, and now she says that she couldn't recall the night in question, that she is unable to back up Christine Blasey Ford's narrative in any detail. And she said she can't figure it out. It'd be impossible for me to be the only girl to get together with three guys, have Blasey Ford leave, and then not figure out how she's going to get home. That doesn't all make sense to me, but that's the quote. I've been thinking about who I was at 16 rather than who Chrissy was at 16. That's when I changed. So these facts together, I don't recollect. It just doesn't make any sense. So she is not a reliable corroborator of the Blasey Ford narrative. And then we get the correction issued by the New York Times quietly and late on Sunday, because in that initial excerpt, they didn't tell readers that the alleged victim didn't even remember the incident. That was the case of the female student at Yale who we talked about yesterday. So the Times also reported on a guy named Max Steer, a former classmate of Kavanaugh at Yale, and they used people who knew Steer to corroborate his story because he has refused to talk to the media. So I'm sorry to say that the reporting on this is not holding up to close scrutiny. The right wing is attacking, and Democrats are, in Congress, are now throwing cold water on the calls, mostly from presidential candidates, to start impeachment proceedings for Brett Kavanaugh. And unfortunately, in this she said, she said, he said situation, it doesn't appear to be promising that this will lead in any useful direction. There is collateral damage fallout from the Jeffrey Epstein case over at MIT. And this one's a little complicated, but computer scientist Richard Stallman has resigned from MIT and from a foundation that he started after leaked emails appeared to show him downplaying a colleague's alleged participation in the sex trafficking of minors by Jeffrey Epstein. And what he did is he sent an email that went public in which he defended his former colleague, the late MIT scientist Marvin Minsky. Now, it's reported by Virginia Jeffrey that she was ordered by Epstein to have sex with Marvin Minsky. And since he's dead, Stallman came to his defense, and his comments are being basically weaponized against him. And I can't say that his comments are all intelligent and useful, but I just hate to see people who had nothing to do with Epstein wind up being penalized for speaking out. Yesterday, I didn't have time to report the story about Andrew Yang and a young man who momentarily was going to be a big star on Saturday Night Live. The young man is a 31-year-old stand-up comic, Shane Gillis. And in a podcast that surfaced after NBC announced his hiring for Saturday Night Live, he was heard calling Andrew Yang a Jew chink. And Andrew Yang told NBC, don't fire this guy. But they ignored his advice. So, Yang has shared a couple of tweets that he sent to Shane Gillis, and the two of them are going to sit down and talk. But what bothers me here is that people who are quoted as being from the Asian American community are slamming Andrew Yang for being willing to forgive Shane Gillis. Here's a quote from, Jen Fang, creator of a long-running Asian American advocacy blog. She said, Yang took a position that's very much at odds with the Asian American community. He's trying to let Shane Gillis off the hook so he can cater to other voters that he needs to get to the White House. Now, this is identity politics where they're trying to dictate how Andrew Yang should react to this. My feeling is that his expression of forgiveness is something we should salute and applaud. Not call him out and try to shame him into an antagonistic position toward Shane Gillis. It's not my feud. And I respect you for the position he's taken. And finally today, we say farewell to an American journalist, Cokie Roberts, who people knew from NPR and ABC Television, where she co-hosted the Sunday morning show for many years. And, she came out of a very well-connected family. Her dad was Hale Boggs, the longtime Democratic fixer from Louisiana, who died in a plane crash in 1972. So Cokie Roberts was wired to the Democratic establishment. She was an inside-the-beltway person. And I give her credit for breaking glass ceilings and those sorts of things. And I just have one quick story to tell. In 1992 or 93, it would have been 93, I think, the hearings for Clarence Thomas's confirmation before the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by one Joe Biden, I sat next to Cokie Roberts for 2 days of the hearings. She didn't take a single note. She worked on knitting a sweater the entire time. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.